This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can now watch our TV show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. The U.S. presidential election this year has inspired severe levels of anxiety, particularly among people of color, who've borne the brunt of violent rhetoric from Donald Trump and his cohorts. If we believe the racist and xenophobic rhetoric, we deserve to be banned from entering the country, or pushed behind a wall, or imprisoned, or priced out of our homes. And if we are poor, we deserve to remain poor. It is a difficult moment indeed, but my guest Jeff Chang in his new book reminds us that we gon' be all right. That's the title of his book, which is a series of thoughtful essays where Chang links the various social trends and movements of our day, ultimately arguing that we are witnessing a great resegregation and that our salvation as a society lies in reversing that trend. Jeff Chang is the executive director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford University, a USA Ford Fellow in Literature, winner of the American Book Award and the Asian American Literary Award. His earlier books were We Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation, and Who We Be, A Cultural History of Race in Post-Civil Rights America. He now joins me to discuss his new book, We Gon' Be All Right, Notes on Race and Resegregation. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Hey, Sonali, it's great to be back.
Thanks so much for joining us. I've loved having you on every time you have a new book out, and I always learn something new. Even though these issues that you discuss in your book are issues that I cover every day on the program, to see it linked with a thread, to see it create a coherent narrative, I think is really important. Can you first lay out for us what you mean by this idea of resegregation? You know, we are told that we are becoming a browner nation. So how is it that whites and people of color are being separated in this country?
Well, the first thing to say is that there are some parts of the country that never desegregated, that have always been segregated. But what we have seen, I think, over the last 50 years during what we've now come to call the post-civil rights era, is a steady chipping away and sometimes wholesale undoing and unraveling, dismantling, if you will, of the infrastructure that was put into place by the civil rights revolution to try to move us all towards racial equity and justice. And so the thing that I think we haven't paid attention to is that this has been happening at the same time that we've diversified greatly, that we've transformed ourselves as a country demographically and culturally. And so this is one of the ideas that I was trying to explore in Who We Be. And, you know, the Who We Be came out, you and I got to talk, I think, back in 2014, before the non-indictment of Darren Wilson came down in Ferguson in the murder of Michael Brown. And so much has happened since then. And so this book became, in some ways, a way to be able to talk about resegregation, but also to be able to pay tribute and give gratitude to the Movement for Black Lives, which has forced us, I think, to reconsider these issues in a very, very urgent kind of a way.
No, but it isn't all black and white, pun intended, right? I mean, we are seeing a wholesale kind of devaluation of work, of labor around the country. And it seems as though the fact that a lot of whites are suffering financially is part of the equation, right?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, one of the things that Donald Trump has been able to do is to sort of decouple this notion of diversity from a sense that we're moving in the right direction, right? So he's been able to make diversity something more than just a sort of, you know, a cliche or a sort of happy, smiling rainbow nation, but he's been able to attach fear to the notion of diversity. And in that regard, I think play to some of the deepest worries that many whites do have. We've seen absolutely declining fortunes for the white middle class and certainly for the white working class. But we've also seen racial division used as a way to be able to move us away from trying to find progressive solutions for moving forward. In this period in which demographics are moving us further and further towards becoming a quote-unquote majority-minority country by the year 2042. And so as long as he's able to do this, as long as he's able to keep resegregation masked and to continue to divide us ideologically, viscerally, emotionally, we're not going to be able to move to a place where the country is going to be able to overcome its legacy of racial inequity and then to be able to move us forward to justice for all.
In your book, you write about Donald Trump's fixation on President Obama's citizenship and his birthplace. And this issue has come back, resurged very recently in the news, with Trump basically saying, okay, I now believe that Obama was born here, and then sort of turning around and saying, well, I only said that so that we can keep the focus on the election. And, you know, many have rightly pointed out that that Trump's fixation on that was extremely detrimental. So, but what was the symbolism? Do you see as Trump's focus starting years ago on Obama's legitimacy as a presidential candidate to be a symbol for the legitimacy of people of color in this country overall, or is that taking it too far?
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that what Trump has shown with pursuing the sort of birtherism that he was pursuing back in 2011, back in 2012, is that fear can outweigh fact. He's placed all of his eggs into the fear basket. And at some point, when there's pushback, when there's sufficient pushback, he's forced to be able to say, well, yeah, I actually didn't mean that after all. I was kind of joking about that. Let's move on. And, you know, and most of the mainstream media, I think, has let him go. They've just sort of let him right off the hook for that. So, you know, this is, again, sort of a perfect example of the kinds of, you know, fears that the Trumpism kind of movement has been able to tap into. What we need to be able to do is to try to see how our movements are connected together, that economic justice for suffering white folks is connected to racial justice for Black folks and other communities of color. That the fight, say, for no DAPL, right, is connected to a safer and more secure environment for everyone. These are the kinds of things that we have to be able to do. But we've got to first recognize that resegregation has been done to us, and that this has happened with either our assent or our indifference. And that's what I'm writing towards in this particular book.
Now, at the same time, young folks, particularly young folks of color, have been really showing up as leaders in a big way in our recent movements over the last few years. You mentioned Black Lives Matter, of course, arguably the most important political movement in the United States today, but also the student-led movements. We're seeing, you know, the national anthem-related protests. You cite in your book the Missouri University protest last year with the hunger strike by Jonathan Butler, and really this kind of shaming of even liberal faces who may spout the idea of diversity on the one hand, but then push policies that end up pushing segregation. How important are these protests, and how important is it for us to expose the liberal faces, not just the right-wing conservative and overtly racist rhetoric?
Well, we could start with the student protests, first of all. I think that what's happened in the liberal discourse about the student protests last fall is that it's been diverted into this really strange kind of discussion about quote-unquote safe spaces and quote-unquote trigger warnings and the so-called threats to freedom of expression that students are apparently really protesting for, which they're not. They're not at all. Students have been protesting to call out, you know, the gap between the picture of diversity, which is what we've been, I think, really sold over the last two decades. I think Hui B was a lot about this, right? The sort of mainstreaming and sort of defanging of multiculturalism, right? The picture of diversity on the one hand, and the reality that campus climate is no better than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. That, in fact, one in four students in the University of California system, same as in 1992, have said that they feel as if they're ready to drop out at any moment. And that's not even including the students who have already dropped out because of a sense of being alienated from the campus, right? By everything from microaggressions to hate violence. And so when students walked out last year on over 100 campuses, the overwhelming numbers of demands were around getting more faculty of color, getting mental health professionals of color, getting more services and classes around questions of race and diversity. Very, very few colleges made any attempt to try to restrict students on college campuses, made any attempt to restrict speech codes. And yet you would think by the debates that we've been seeing in the mainstream press that that's all that they were about, that they were about rising up to shut down professors and to squelch free speech on campus. That hasn't been the case at all. It's been a huge overreaction, a hysterical overreaction to what has been a legitimate protest around the resegregation of our educational system and of the results that that creates in our systems of higher education. And so, you know, again, I think that we have it within our hands, the opportunity to be able to turn this around. But we've got to look at what's really happening out there. We can't be sort of taken away by these sort of fantasies of the end of whiteness or the end of power relations that are better for us. We're trying to imagine what could be a better society, and we're doing that in all these different types of places, from the streets of Charlotte, you know, to the campuses and all around.
Jeff, in your book, We Gonna Be All Right, Notes on Race and Resegregation, you have a chapter on cultural equity, which I thought was really interesting because, you know, you might argue at a time when police are shooting young unarmed black men every other day, black women as well, trans people as well, that this idea that we need to see diversity in our TV shows at the Oscars might be a little, superficial or trivial. But why is it important? Why is cultural equity why is pop culture and diversity in pop culture important?
It all begins with culture, right? Mm-hmm. Cultural change precedes political change. And what we've had is a shift, I think, in the picture. But we haven't necessarily had a shift in the power. And so, again, we have the picture of diversity, right? This has been a huge change since the 1990s. And yet, if you look, for instance, at all of the different sectors that produce our culture, from, say, the museums to the culture industry, all the way on through, what we've seen is that leadership hasn't changed and that voices of the marginalized are still as marginalized as ever. And so when the Oscars So White controversy broke out last year, people might have thought, well, this is an interesting diversion from what's really happening in the streets, right? I see it as all part of the same type of thing, right? That we've seen resegregation of the culture. And now, I think in the last couple of years, attempts to be able to call that out and decisions being made that have maybe pushed us around a little bit. We've seen, for instance, the first woman of color appointed to be the head of a TV studio. at ABC. But at the same time, the overwhelming majority of leadership positions, the people who make decisions about what we see, what we hear, whom we read, these positions are overwhelmingly dominated by white folks. And so the picture of diversity is not enough. In order to have true equity, we have to move towards having access, representation, and power opened up to all. And I think that that's really the reality of it at this particular point. That's why people are calling this out. At the end of the day, we know that the culture allows us the imagination to be able to see past the political moment, right? If we're in a stalemate politically, we have to be able to have the culture continue to make possible for us ideas, songs, stories, narratives that imagine, that allow us to imagine another world as possible.
Right.
And so cultural equity in that sense is really, really crucial for us being able to move to a better society.
And it feels like, you know, for people of color to see reflections of ourselves on our screens is very empowering. And it's also important for power dynamics between powerful groups and less powerful groups to see each other as more human, which culture has the power to do. You place great importance, Jeff, in your book on Beyoncé, and in particular, her really game-changing video sort of artistic directorial piece, Lemonade. And she is so unapologetic in this. You know, if she's come under criticism for trying to be the you know, sort of a black Bill Gates, if you will, as she herself uses it, and to promote, you know, designer dresses. But why is Beyoncé a symbol who is important culturally?
I was writing the book, and as I got to the end, Lemonade dropped, and everything kind of stopped for a lot of folks, right, when Lemonade dropped for a couple of days. And I realized at the end of it, actually, this is something that I really want to write about. I mean, Beyoncé is asking us to hear and see Lemonade, right? Because she released it as an album, as a visual album as well. But to hear and see Lemonade in the context of the movement for Black Lives. And so she's got the call out on songs like Freedom, right? But at the same time, like there's a way in which this narrative of a broken relationship, right, in which she's been in many ways hurt and harmed by her lover, stands in as a really interesting metaphor for race relations at this particular moment. And the idea that she moves from feeling broken, feeling depressed, feeling angry through trying to find some sort of a way to move to grace and to transform herself and feel her own power. And even towards reconciliation, I think, offers us a really interesting view into the notion of transformational justice, which is a key part of the Movement for Black Lives platform. It's if you go to the map, the Movement for Black Lives agenda, it's defined within there. But transformational justice is this notion that Grace Lee Boggs has kind of forwarded, right? Which is that revolution doesn't need to be bloody, that it's about raising consciousness. And in this sense, to me, it was Lemonade was this beautiful statement on how to imagine what could come out of all of this, all of the hatred, the division, the violence that we've been torn apart by historically, but also especially over the last few years.
Jeff Chang is my guest, and he's going to be doing a number of speaking events around the Bay Area and other parts of the country. You can find out more at jeffchang.net/events and see where you can might be able to catch him speak in person. He's the executive director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford University. His earlier books were Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip Hop Generation, and Who We Be, A Cultural History of Race in Post-Civil Rights America. We've been discussing Jeff Chang's latest book, We Gonna Be All Right, Notes on Race and Resegregation. I'm going to keep Jeff on for an extended interview, which you can get in the on-demand premium section of our website. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Twitter at twitter.com/RUwithSonali. Jeff, you went from, we went as a society and with the leadership of Black Lives Matter, went from this extremely powerful and explosive moment in Ferguson, Missouri, to what you pointed out recently, this platform released by the Movement for Black Lives, a vision for the kind of world that that people want to live in. All of that's happened within a very few short years. Maybe that's been accelerated because of social media and our ability to communicate with one another at lightning speed. But how important is it for us to acknowledge the real victories, even though in practical levels there's still not enough police officers behind bars for killing Black folks, the dialogue has completely changed and it's put people like the Donald Trump supporters on the defensive. But this journey from Ferguson to that vision, a platform released by the Movement for Black Lives, happening in such a short amount of time, is that crucial?
Yeah, I think it is. Thanks, Sonali. That's a really good question. I mean, it's a perfect example, too, of how fast the culture can change. You know, we were talking earlier about how important it is to be able to have a foothold, a foundation within the culture, to be able to understand that culture leads us in terms of us imagining what can happen. And I think what we've seen is over the last 5 years, really, moment after moment in which there's this sort of spike that occurs, this inflection point that occurs within the culture that then allows us to be able to shift the debate in a really dramatic way. I mean, you could talk about Occupy, right? And suddenly everybody talking about the 99%, and that impacting greatly now the presidential elections that we are seeing. Of course, we're not all the way there. We're not even part of the way there, really. But the importance of being able to have these cultural interventions move the dial is really, really important. And I think that the Movement for Black Lives has created in so many ways sort of fertile ground for us to be able to reimagine what society can look like. And it's created, I think, an amazing renaissance of art, if you will, not just in the Black community, in Black music, for instance, which I talk and write about all the time, and which has been profoundly shifted, I think, in the last 2 years. But in, you know, contemporary arts, in what I think we have seen happening even at Standing Rock, in the undocumented movement, all the way around, we've seen, I think, new hope being offered. And so again, the book in so many ways is a note of gratitude to the Movement for Black Lives for being able to ignite our imaginations. And now the work comes in terms of figuring out how we join these different types of ideas together in order to sort of revitalize an oppositional politics and aesthetics in our country. Mm-hmm.
Finally, Jeff, I want to talk about what it really reads as a very personal essay near the end of your book about being Asian American. You know, and as a fellow Asian American, I can relate to the title. The In-Betweens is the chapter title on Asian Americanness, and you know, it's a really interesting place to be at this moment in time. To be neither white nor black, the stereotypical immigrant, which is the Latino, but to be Asian, which often automatically puts us in a place of success through the stereotypes, but ignores also that history that Asian Americans have had in being alongside movements for racial justice. But your story is very personal, and I'm wondering if you can sort of summarize it for us, how your own journey as an Asian American informed your views on race.
Wow, that's a lot. But Yeah, you know, I couldn't write a book about this moment and what the movement for Black Lives has opened up for us without writing about my own particular positionality as someone who comes from Chinese and Native Hawaiian descent, somebody who's Asian and Pacific Islander. And, you know, in so many ways, it's like you said, we get placed in between black and white. And so, you know,
and you were raised in Hawaii?
I was born and raised in Hawaii, and I've been living up here on the continent now for more than half my life, mainly in California, but across the country as well in different spots. But you know, the thing to note is that one of the privileges of being in between is that we can choose to sit on the fence. We can choose to sit out the running battles. We can choose to sort of, you know, see who's going to win the fight and then ally ourselves with that. That's a privilege, I think, that we have as Asian Pacific Islanders. And I was writing to question that, to kind of point that out and to say that in this particular moment and really all the time, we've got to be able to choose sides. We have to be able to say, are we going to sort of perpetuate this structure that upholds whiteness, right? And allows certain folks to be able to get in, to get over? Or are we going to be about the liberation of everyone? Are we going to, in that regard, you know, look at the history of freedom struggles led by African Americans and by indigenous folks and Latino folks and ally ourselves and our history, align ourselves and progressive whites with that? Or are we going to sort of fall in with the status quo, be content to kind of have crumbs to get the crumbs on the table. I've made up my mind on that, right? But I also wanted to explore the ambivalences that creates, the sort of dissonances that creates within our families, amongst our communities as well, in order to try to really kind of uncover and understand the in-betweens. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, right, I'll tell it like this. We were in Ferguson, and the activists there have revived the old sort of folk song that was used in the Appalachian coal miners' strike many years ago. It was written for it, "Which Side Are You On?" And there's a line in there, "There are no neutrals here," right? There are no neutrals in Harlan County. There are no neutrals in St. Louis County. There are no neutrals now, I think, in the U.S. We can't be neutral anymore. We have to get off the fence. We have to take our side, and we have to be on the side of liberation.
Well, Jeff, on that note, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you with the book and your book events, which our audience can find at jeffchang.net/events. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
Jeff Chang is the executive director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford University. His earlier books were Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation, and Who We Be, A Cultural History of Race in Post-Civil Rights America. We've been discussing his new book, We Gon' Be All Right, Notes on Race and Resegregation. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.